All right. Let's begin with our blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher bachar banu mikol amim V'natan lanu et torato Baruch atah Adonai Notein haTorah. A few housekeeping things. This will be our last class today for the next 2 weeks. I'll, God willing, be leaving for Israel next Wednesday and to visit our kids and grandchildren for Hanukkah. But we will resume, God willing, come back healthy. We're coming back on Wednesday, December 4th, and so we'll plan to have class on Thursday, December 5th. So that will be the eighth day of Hanukkah, so that should be a very nice way to end up the holiday. So I'll plan to see you. If you see anybody, I'll send out an email, but if you see anybody who you think is coming, just to let them know not to make a trip here. And if there's anybody who's not on my email list, if you want to give me your email so that you're on the list, that way you'll receive any and all notifications. I'd love to say I'd be sending you all deals for the day or something like that, but I don't have that to offer you. But I'll send you information. The other thing I wanted to let you know about, and I did send out an email about this, is this performance, this women's performance. It's called Broadway Unbound, and it is written and directed and performed by Denver's own Rivka Cohen, and it follows really her story, the pursuit of her ultimate dream, but her passion to perform collides with her passion for truth and her seeking a Jewish life in a way that precludes the kind of performance that she would originally have wanted to do, but how she's found her way in a new venue. So she's created this performance. It's Monday, December 9th, $36, 7 o'clock. It's at the Plus Theater at the JCC.
Also, I don't know if it's still there, but at the Plus Theater, there was a show called La Door by Door.
Oh, really?
About three generations of women.
Oh, nice.
That's really quite lovely and very provocative. If you haven't seen it, I think I saw that it was still here. And there's some group or some Jewish group that's come to Denver to do this.
Great.
It's worth
JCC?
At the JCC.
Great. Thank you, Diane. Okay, good. This week's Parsha takes us to Parsha Vayishlach, which is on page 171, is truly a continuation of last week's Parsha. Jacob, Yaakov, has left the house of Laban with his children, and he is about to meet up with Esav. And so we're going to take a look at a number of different things in this Parsha, and I just want to introduce it by saying that there was a beautiful connection that I was so happy to make, and that we're going to talk about it from the opening part, the opening lines in the Parsha, and that is on page 171, verse 4 and 5, and if we could start with that and read. Amanda, would you like to read that for us? Verses 4 and 5.
And Jacob sent angels ahead of him, and Esau his brother, to the land of Seir, the field of Edom. He charged them, saying, "Thus you shall say to my lord, to Esau, so said your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and have lingered."
Okay, and we had mentioned it a little bit last week, but we're going to focus where it says, "I have sojourned with Laban," meaning his father-in-law, "and have lingered until now," and that the Hebrew for that is im lavan, with Laban, garti, I have sojourned. So the word garti, which we have looked at, to say that it has the same numerical equivalent as 613. So the gimel is 3, the resh is 200, the tav is 400, the yud is 10, altogether equals 613, meaning that even though he was living with Laban, who was evil, he observed all 613 commandments. But more so than that, and when Rashi comments on it, he says not only did he perform the 613 commandments, but he did not take on any of Laban's evil ways, that he maintained his integrity. Because it is possible, not really so easy, but it is possible to be in technical fulfillment of all of the commandments, but still be influenced by the culture and the people around you so that you are a little kind of schmutzy from their experience. It is still rubbed off on you, and I can't think of it, that's a very profound spiritual term. It's like there's a way that you can kind of still be in technical compliance, and that you can be performing everything, and you get credit for that. That's all well and good, is to perform all the mitzvot, because we are commanded to perform them. But there's a way where it still does not settle into the person's essence of who they are, and so they have not been deeply affected and impacted by the mitzvot they perform. So a person can light Shabbos candles and perform the mitzvah, but the spiritual light and the meaning of it can not have any impact on them. It's just like they lit candles, just like they lit them for a dinner party. So it is totally possible to have it not go in. So what Yaakov is saying here is he lived with Laban, and not only did he perform the mitzvot, but he did not take on any of the attitudes or the ways of being in the world of Laban, who was a trickster and a cheat and everything else, and that Yaakov maintained his integrity of who he was. He maintained his identity, he maintained his integrity, notwithstanding. In fact, we could say that probably the struggle of being in that environment for that whole time strengthened him to be able to withstand and maintain his integrity. It's not that we usually go looking for trouble and put ourselves in situations, and we're not really supposed to put ourselves into situations where we think we're going to be in an environment that's going to really test us and test our ethics, our morals, or anything else, our integrity. We're not really supposed to do that. But it is true that it's possible to have that strength in a person. And Yaakov was strengthened by that. And he is called a man of truth, as opposed to Laban, who was a man of deceit. And that specifically Yaakov, as we know, did not sit in the tents and only was learning, though that would have been very meritorious, but he was a man in business. He was Laban's shepherd. He was doing business. Laban tried to cheat him, and Yaakov did not respond with what could have been a totally justifiable response, which is, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and if he's a cheater, in order to stay in business, I need to cheat too. It's not because I really want to, it's just that's how it is in the business world. That's just how it is. Susan.
Well, it was reminding me of what you said before about having been one of the very few Jewish children in the non-Jewish environment, and how that strengthened.
Right.
And so I wonder whether, I guess it's risky, but
it's risky. They can be, but they're risky. They're really risky. As I said, all the other kids all assimilated and are married and are gone. So it was risky. It was very risky. We were very fortunate. Jacob was able to withstand it, which is an amazing thing. And it's because his essence of truth, but it wasn't easy. And he blasts Laban when they met up in the Parsha before, and he says, you know, you changed my wages 100 times. I had to keep doing things to undo and not be victimized. So that's a challenge, because he wasn't just like, okay, victimize me because I'm such an honest man. He was assertive, but he was within the framework of the law, and he maintained his integrity. And again, that's very hard if you're in a culture where everybody is cheating and being a little, you know, sly and slippery. It's very easy to think, well, you know, you can't make it unless you just do that. Like, I'm honest in everything else except in that. So he was not like that. So that integrity that he had specifically through business was something is interesting, because we're told that after we pass into the next world, we're going to be asked a series of questions for our final judgment. And the first question that we're going to be asked, does anyone know what the first question is? That's the second. Did you set aside time for Torah? You would think that'd be the first one. The very first one is?
Were you honest in your business?
Were you honest in your business dealings? So here's the trick on that. That's how it's always translated, as were you honest in your business dealings. The Hebrew is not honest. It doesn't say honest. It says, did you transact business? Were you involved in business be'emuna, with faith and trust? Did you do your business faithfully and with trust, meaning, and that's something different than honesty. Honesty means you followed the laws. Okay, there's business laws and I did everything right. Hopefully you did that. Emuna has more to do with our relationship with God. That I do business with God, not with whatever's going on with my competitors in the market. Meaning, if I can't cheat, not because I want to be an honest person, but because I have faith in God that if God wants me to have a certain amount of money, God will see to it that I have that amount of money. So there is no reason for me to cheat, because it will never really work anyway, and it's a betrayal of my faith in God. And it has more to do with I do business with God. Everybody else is really irrelevant. really irrelevant. So I thought this was so appropriate for this week, because I'm sure many people have seen on the internet this week the rabbi who found the $98,000. Did everybody see that story? Oh, this is so great. Such a kiddush Hashem, such a sanctification of God's name. This is a rabbi and his wife bought a desk on Craigslist for like $200, and they got it to their house, and it didn't fit through the door into their study, and so they had to take it apart, and when they took it apart, they found a bag with $98,000 cash in it. And what do you think he did with the money? Of course. He called the woman and said, "We found this money." And his answer was not, and his initial answer, and I got the quote exactly, "If God wants us to have $98,000, he'll make sure to give it to us in some other way." And it wasn't the poor lady who, it's her money, it's her inheritance. It wasn't so much about honesty. You see why there's just a slight difference? It's not just honesty, it's honesty plus. My money comes from Hashem. Money that comes to me from Hashem comes honestly. I don't even want any part of any money that doesn't come that way, because I do business with God. That is a statement of emunah more so than honesty. And it's a ratchet above, because it goes above and beyond. Now that I've read a whole bunch of things online, people saying, well, of course anybody would return that because they too feel too guilty, like this little old lady and her inheritance and it's her money. And if it was like from a store, you know, maybe they wouldn't, but from a person, people would. And thank God that's true. The truth is, I think probably most people would return it. I really do. Maybe that's my faith in humanity. I think most people would, or many people would. It's not uniquely a Jewish rabbi is the only person on earth. What is, I find very interesting, maybe a statement about the times that we live in, that people are so depressed and discouraged by so much wrongdoing in the world that it's so heartwarming to hear about somebody doing the right thing. So I think that that's one thing. But I think there's also something else, which is the world knows that the Jewish people have a higher standard, and they are happy when a Jewish person performs at the level that they're supposed to perform at. It was like 2 weeks ago with the Jewish man with the kippah on the subway, having a person fall asleep on him, a black man with a hoodie. And everyone was so excited. And if someone said, you know, well, that's no big deal. I had someone fall asleep on me and they were drooling. You know, like, what's the big thing? I've had someone fall asleep on me. I fell asleep on my daughter's teacher at I was driving carpool for a field trip and we went to the planetarium. Me in the dark in the afternoon sitting still. My daughter's so embarrassed. I fell asleep on her teacher. Anyway, it's not crazy that people fall asleep, and nobody ever makes such a big deal about it. But it was the juxtaposition, first of all, of somebody black and somebody Caucasian,
especially
number one.
On the
and on the subway.
People don't touch each other.
I know, it's like, ugh. And then he would sit there and he was like, you know, and his empathy was like, this man has had a tiring day. Let him sleep. And that was like, the world wants to see the Jewish people being the Jewish people. It disappoints and upsets people when we're not, and it's like, here they are. I thought, this is great. Maybe we're on a roll. Maybe there'll be something next week of something else. So it was interesting. I think because that happened, and reading this parsha, this was just my own little thing. I'm not saying it was so great, but it put it in my mind, and we should make it clear to people that the reason we do business the way we do is because we're Jewish, because that is the epitome of most integrity, honesty, and faith in God is how a Jewish person is supposed to do business. So we had some landscaping work done, and we needed to buy a timer for a soaking hose because we were going to be out of town, and we had new vegetation, and it had to be watered. And this was back in, I don't even know when it was, like in June. And they hadn't sent me the bill for the timer. And the woman came over to kind of check to see how everything was doing, and I said, you know, I didn't get the bill for the timer. She was like, oh, I forgot all about it. She goes, you're so honest. I said, I'm Jewish. I do business with God. And only because of this whole thing, that would not have just fallen out of my mouth normally. But I thought, she said, well, that's really wonderful. I'm like, this is what we're trying to portray in the world. And then it holds us. We speak the standard, and we have to hold ourselves to it. Hazel.
And yet, you know, I've had an experience when somebody has said something like, they try to Jew me down.
That's right.
And so I had to say something.
You should say something, absolutely.
I think it's important.
We have to speak up.
What do you say?
You tell somebody that's an offensive term,
right.
And a lot of people don't use it. They don't even know what they're talking about. They say it just like how we say anything. Somebody gypped me. You know, I don't have anything against gypsies. I don't even, you know, it's just like a term. But yeah, we need to call people on it. And even more than correcting that is on the affirmative of saying that I do business with God. This is an expression of faith. Now, I'm not saying you have to go around and announce that like you're a Target and you return, you know, like a chain. I do business with God. Here's your quarter. You know, some stores, they don't even know what to do if you give their money back. They're like, what? Like, we already rang it up. Like, I don't know what to do with it. So you're like, cause a problem. But anyway, to have this in mind is we do business with God. And this is what Yaakov is saying is, Im Lavan Garti, I lived with Laban. I observed the mitzvot, and I did not learn anything from his ways. I did not absorb the cultural norms, not just of Laban. That was the whole community, and he was there for many years. It's one thing if you're just kind of passing through. Like, if you go to visit a place, you don't automatically start absorbing all of their cultural norms. You're a visitor, you're passing through. So he also says that, Im Lavan Garti. So the word Garti, the word gar, lagur, it means to be kind of a temporary dweller, that you're there just short term, so that even though he was there for, what, like 22 years or however long he was, 17 years, how long was he there? He was there a long time. I forgot. He was 20, I'm sorry?
I'm going to say 21, but 21? I think there was 2 7-year deals in that.
Okay.
There was an additional.
The additional years, okay. So he was there a long time. That's a long time to say you're just passing through. But that's also the Jewish attitude towards being in this world, is we're just passing through. And everything we want to do, we don't want to sink into the world. There's one thing about being in the world but not of the world. That we're in the world, and he was working, and he was working productively and raising his family. He had 11 of his 12 children there, actually 12 because he had Dina as well. So he was definitely there, but he saw himself as, I'm just passing through. I'm not getting attached to this place. So that when in Rome, do as the Romans, we don't believe in that. It's like, when in Rome, do as the Jews. That is what we do. That's our belief all the time. And it's interesting how sometimes people think that when they go on vacation, that they're on vacation from their Judaism as well. It's like, oh, well, you know, I do this and this. If I'm in Denver, maybe some people expand it to Colorado or the Midwest. But if I go here or there, certainly if I leave the country, I have different standards. I do, you know, like whatever. I'm on vacation from being Jewish, kind of. Because I'm just doing what everybody else is doing. So that's really not where we're supposed to be headed. So Yaakov is saying in that one phrase, Im Lavan Garti, I lived with Laban. I did not absorb any of the ways he had of doing business, and specifically in business when he was trying to cheat me, where you could say, well, if he's going to cheat me, I will cheat him back. That's a justified feeling. And he's like, I do business with God. I can answer the question that I do my business with Emunah, and I will do things that are only legal, legitimate, and appropriate, no matter what, regardless of what the other person is doing on the other side. Yes,
so,
Judy.
This is back to when she talked about chewing down. Is bargaining considered not a good thing?
No, bargaining's fine, as long as you're in a place where bargaining is done. I remember my grandmother, bless her heart, Zichrona Livracha. She used to love to bargain. She lived on the East Coast. And when she used to come to Denver to visit, my father, her son, would say, Mom, they don't bargain at King Soopers. You cannot go in and say, this pair, you want me to pay this much? I'll give you whatever. It's like, that's not what you do. You can't do that. So she said, I don't know, maybe. So maybe some of you do that. But that's like, when you can do it, when it's environmental. No, bargaining is fine. In fact, it's considered, you know, some. Yeah, it is very offensive, and they mean like dripping, they mean in a negative way, like I got the better end of it. Usually a bargain should be to the benefit of both the purchaser and the seller. Okay, so yeah, we don't go for that. So, and he says that in Im Lavan Garti, is I was a sojourner there. I may have been there for a long time, had my kids, and that's the other thing, is he had to protect all of his kids from this environment as well, because when your children are young, they really absorb the atmosphere that you're around and take in whatever's happening in the culture. And then he was able to protect his entire family. It wasn't just about himself as Yaakov, but all of the children as well. Diane.
Ellen, I knew it was clash. Where is the information that all of this
is coming from?
Yeah.
It's from Rashi is one of the commentators, and there are many other commentators. So some of these, if it's just one commentator, it'll name the person. And then the other word that's used is if it's kind of all the sages say so, kind of like everybody says so and knows so. It says Chazal, which means Chachamim Zichrona Livracha, our sages of blessed memory, that it's known from the oral law, from the Midrashim, from Rashi, text, all of that is where this is all coming from. So, good question. Okay, great question. Okay, so this is what Yaakov is saying, and it also, we can know that it means something, because why is that, that would be the first thing that he wants Esau to know? This is this whole thing where he's saying, thus shall you say to my Lord, to Esau, so said your servant Jacob. You would think, oh, that there's going to be some huge pronouncement. So, and then what's the huge pronouncement? I've sojourned with Laban. It's like, so, like, I knew you were gone. I knew you were there. The whole family knew you were there. So why say that unless there's something significant about announcing that to let Esau know that Yaakov had not fallen in his spiritual level, even though he'd left the land of Israel, which was the other thing. Esau had stayed in the land of Israel to live with his parents and give honor to them. Jacob left the land of Israel. That usually brings somebody down a notch or two. And he's saying, I didn't go down a notch or two, or any notches, by being outside of the land of Israel. So it's just like letting Esau know who he is and who he's dealing with and what he can expect. So that's from that perspective there of with Laban, I have sojourned. Okay. Then the next part we want to look at, oh, just going back a little bit to the very first sentence when it says, then Jacob sent angels ahead of him. So there's actually two understandings. One is that the angels were, because the Hebrew word is malachim, which is a malach is an angel. So one is that a malach means a messenger, and it can mean a human messenger. So one opinion is that he sent messengers that were people. But Rashi, for Diane, says, if you look in the Hebrew, it says, just like right under the Hebrew text, Vayishlach Yaakov malachim, and then it says malachim mamash. It means he sent real angels.
Exactly.
Not just angels, we're just using this term, and it really means people. He says, no, he sent real angels. You're like, wow, that's interesting. Yaakov had angels in his camp? That doesn't sound like most people. So it says Yaakov was at such a level that spiritually, that he had command of spiritual forces, and that he could send angels, so that he had that at his disposal. So it's interesting when people say to me, like, oh, I don't think Jews believe in angels. It's like, just look throughout the Torah. We believe in angels. Look throughout our liturgy. We believe in angels. So everything is about, yes, we have lots of angels, and Yaakov had sent angels. There it says, Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lifanav, before him to Esav his brother. So he sent actual angels, again, an indication of Yaakov's very high level, and that he did it and was able to summon them to do his bidding. Okay. The next part that is very interesting to talk about is on page 173, verse 11. Actually, we'll go back to we're going to read verses 8 through 12, and we'll just go around, and each person can take one verse. So, Ronnie, would you like to go ahead?
Jacob became very frightened, and it distressed him. So he divided the people with him, and the cattle, herds, and camels into two camps.
Okay, Stella?
For he said, if Esau comes to the one camp and strikes it down, then the remaining camp shall survive.
Then Jacob said, God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, Hashem who said to me, return to your land and to your relatives, and I will do good with you.
I have been diminished by all the kindnesses and by all the truth that you have done your servant. For with my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps.
Okay, we'll read just verse 12 also.
Rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him lest he come and strike me down, mother and children.
Okay. So this is Jacob becoming prepared to meet up with Esau, and he's frightened, and he is frightened. And it distressed him that he was frightened. It's like, why am I scared? Does that mean that fear is actually sometimes a sign of lack of trust in God? Like, do I not trust God? God made me a promise that he was going to protect me and do everything for me, so why am I feeling scared? And what he's saying here is, I have been diminished by all the kindnesses and by all the truth that you have done your servant, is even though Jacob has been a very active participant in his life, he attributes all of the benefit to God, and he feels like he has kind of used up his merit, used up his good graces, used up his, you know, points that he has, and that there won't be enough now when he meets up with Esav, and that that's going to cause a problem. So it says, this is how a person should always feel. No one should ever feel so self-righteous of like, I'm so good, I know God's going to do A, B, or C for me. It's like, God made him a direct promise, so it's not that he's doubting God's promise, but that we should always feel that maybe I'm not, you know, maybe I'm not as great as I thought I was, and I don't want to rest on my laurels, and I'm not going to say, well, you know, I know God hates Esau and he loves me, so I'm fine. We should never have that kind of cocky self-assurance. This doesn't mean not having confidence to go into our life, because there's an underlying confidence, but we shouldn't be cocky. And Yaakov was not cocky, and he feels like, I've been diminished. I feel kind of small and indebted because of everything that God has, bless you, has done for me, because he allowed Yaakov to be able to persevere and to kind of overcome what Laban had in store for him. And he's attributing it to God. So he's not saying, well, I'm so smart, I know I figured out all this stuff to do against Laban so that I would be okay. He's not saying that. He's saying, God did incredible kindness with me. So he says to, in his description here, it says, for with my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. So it says, with my staff I crossed this Jordan. It means coming into Haran. When he left his parents and went to Haran, it says he crossed with his staff. And when it says that, it means his staff and nothing else. The only thing he had was his staff. And that was because we talked about last week that Eliphaz, who was Esau's son, that Esau sent Eliphaz to go kill Yaakov after Yaakov left, and Eliphaz goes and meets him, and he's torn. He wants to honor his father by killing Yaakov, which is a strange way of honoring your parent, but he also wants to fulfill the Torah and not commit murder, because he grew up in the home where he knows what the halacha is. So Yaakov tells him, take everything I own. A person who has nothing is kind of as good as dead. And tell your father, you did kill me, and that I'm gone. And he said, this is like, the only thing you need to leave for me is, as this was from Rabbi Abba Wagensberg, is just one piece of carry-on luggage. You know, just let me carry one thing. But he didn't even have carry-on luggage. The only thing he had was the clothes on his back and his staff. So it says, with my staff I crossed the Jordan and nothing else. And why did he want to keep his staff? It wasn't like he was old and infirm and needed a walking stick. It said the staff was very important to him. And in it, inside the staff, there was oil. And in that oil, which we have talked about in previous years, this is our tie-in to a pre-Hanukkah, says this is the oil that was passed down from Noah, that came from the olives that were pressed, from the olives that were brought by the dove, who brought the olive back after the flood, that was passed down and down to the patriarchs, and that went to Yaakov. So that it was kind of a hollow makel, it was a hollow staff, and in it was the oil. And so that oil was very important to him, more important to him because of its spiritual connection than all of his other possessions he had. He said, you can take everything else, I just want my staff. That's the only thing I need. Could say if he needed a walking stick, you're walking around. So I remember going on hikes, you can find a stick somewhere, so find another stick. So it wasn't just a stick, it was his staff, and inside that there was the oil there. Did you have a question? Oh, no, Helene.
So what was the intention of the oil?
Go ahead.
Of course it came from, it was a very spiritual thing, but in addition to being a spiritual thing, they anointed kings, they did all those kinds of things. What was the intention of it?
So interestingly, Yaakov used some of that oil, because if we go back to Parsha Vayetze, after he has his dream, let's go back to that and see what it says that he does.
So he had the staff and he had the dream?
Yes. Okay. He had the whole thing there. And okay, if you go up to page 147, and you can read verse 18 for us. Page 147, verse 18.
Jacob arose early in the morning and took the stone that he placed around his head and set it up as a pillar, and he poured oil on its top.
And then you can... And then verse 19, and he names that place Beit El, which means the house of God. That's this oil. It was in his staff. It was the oil that was in his staff because he didn't have anything else. This dream was post-Eliphaz. So it was passed down. Isaac gave it to him. Isaac gave it, who got it from Abraham, who got it from, you know, from. It was passed down to him. This oil was then passed down, and the small crews that was finally left of the little bit, that's the oil that the Hashmonaim found for the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash, for the temple that was used to kindle the menorah that lasted the extra nights, because that oil has to do with spiritual perseverance and being able to overcome, which is why that oil, that olive tree, after the flood, the olive tree is known for its perseverance, and the Jewish people are known for its ability, and we are given the blessing that we will persevere despite all of the obstacles, despite all of the odds. So when he uses that oil and he names that place Beit El, the house of God, that is the place in the future that becomes the Beit HaMikdash, that becomes the temple. So he anoints it first with that oil, and then it will be rededicated again, and then finally by the Hashmonaim, the Hasmoneans, who find the final little cruse of oil, because there is a halacha that said that they did not need to use pure oil to light the menorah when they had the rededication. It was not required. Halachically, there's a whole thing. It does not have to be pure. If you're rededicating it, there's this whole, I don't know, the halacha of it. But for that Hanukkah, that very first Hanukkah, they wanted it to be only the purest of the pure, because that was the whole point, was the purification of the temple, the purification of the Jewish people, to separate, like Yaakov did, from the Hellenists, to separate from the Greek worldview and culture that was designed to try to just kind of, you know, trap us in and get us to be participate in their lifestyle rather than the Jewish lifestyle. It says that oil was all about exactly what the message of Hanukkah. So it's not just to light the menorah, you had to have pure oil, you didn't. But for this, the Hanukkah, it comes from that. So this parsha is always read during the month of Kislev, right around Hanukkah. It is always read around there, and that's one of the references we have, is Yaakov bringing that oil, and he brings that with him. So it's just like, Eliphaz, you can have everything else, everything else. He didn't have one penny to his name. The only thing he had was his staff. Susan?
You said that Bethel was where the temple was?
That's where the temple will be built in the future, Beit El.
Oh, in the future.
Yes, right, Beit El.
The oil came from Abraham?
Came from Noah originally.
Noah.
From the olives that the dove brought back after the flood, and then it's kept, and it was passed on. Yaakov has it as the heir to the, he's the one who is the heir to the spiritual legacy that carries forward, and that gets passed down, and then it ends up in the small amount left of a cruse that was hidden away by the Kohanim, because the Hasmoneans were Kohanim. So it was hidden away, and that's what they found to use. Susan.
The temple,
the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Yerushalayim. So it was Beit El originally. Valerie.
If Esau's son was supposedly supposed to kill Jacob, then how did Esau know that he was still alive?
Because he came back with all of his stuff. So it's like as if he were dead.
Then Esau came after him. He was supposed to think he was dead, wasn't he?
I think, I'm not sure how that, I don't know if it was like, if Esau also then was, felt justified since Yaakov had been given blessings, like he was going to have all of this wealth, and now Esau had it because Eliphaz brought it all back, that it was as good as dead. If you strip somebody of everything they have, it says they're as good as dead. So it's as good as dead. Just tell them you did away with me. I have nothing. I am done. I'm done. Gabi.
The dream was Har Moriah, where the temple is.
Yes.
Beit El, the same place?
Yes. All of this is the same place. Har Moriah, Beit El, place where the Beit HaMikdash and Yerushalayim, all the same place.
So not the town of Beit El.
Not the town of Beit El. No. Okay.
Was Esau really coming after Jacob? I read one of the commentaries that I read was that Jacob actually was going after Esau to make up or get that he could have actually traveled, because Esau's just going his merry way down the road or whatever, doing his thing, and it was Jacob that was actually going to seek Esau, not the other way around.
Okay, that's also true, that there was going to be a meeting one way or the other because Yaakov had been told to go back home. So if you're going home, one way or another, you're going to meet up Esau. is it going to be a meeting that's going to turn into a confrontation? Is it a confrontation that he's waiting to hear? He didn't know what it was going to be, and so he's prepared for a confrontation. And he's going also to meet him. And he also, Yaakov is a very complex person because he has appreciation for the fact that he has the blessing and Esau doesn't. In fact, him giving this whole tribute to him is a way of saying, here, you take it. You take it. It's almost not undoing the blessing, but saying, I don't need it. You take it. And it's almost, he had sympathy and empathy for Esau not having the blessing. And at the same time, he didn't have so much sympathy that it was going to let him take his life out. There's a limit to how much sympathy you have. Before you played dead.
He was basically preparing for the worst.
He's playing for the worst and hoping for the best.
It wasn't as though Esau was actually seeking Jacob out.
Well, we're not sure, because the Malachim, when they come back, what do they say? They have, unfortunately, he says he's coming with 400 men. Yeah. So that's on page 171. And it says he's heading towards you. Okay, so verse 7. And why don't you read that for us, Kay? Verse 7.
The angels returned to Jacob, saying, we came to your brother, to Esau. Moreover, he is heading toward you, and 400 men are with him.
Okay, so 400 men with you is like, you know, that doesn't sound so good. And it didn't sound like Esau didn't send any presents along the way. It wasn't like, I'm so glad you're coming home. So if someone's meeting you with 400 men, you need to assume the worst and be prepared for that. And so that's, yeah, still.
Especially since he wasn't cowed or intimidated by the angels.
No, he certainly wasn't, and it's interesting. No, he was not cowed or intimidated by that at all. So, I mean, Esau, probably living in Yitzchak's home, was used to angels also. I mean, Abraham had angels around also. So, I mean, this was kind of like a family thing. We're like used to this. Oh, yeah, the angels. Okay, so, but have someone comes at you with 400 men, and we assume they were armed. They weren't coming bearing gifts. You have to assume the worst. And Yaakov he didn't say, well, like, what's his problem? You know, what's his problem? He was like, oh, this is a problem. This could be a big problem, and my whole family is at risk, and I need to make preparations. And he makes preparations with all of this. You know, he's going to come to him, and he's going to bow 7 times and call him my Lord and give him this whole tribute and give him all this stuff. He's trying to appease him. And it's not just appeasing someone because you think they have no merit, but you're going to do it as a tactic. He's appeasing him because he senses there is some merit in there. He's sensitive to the fact that Esau lost the blessing. He is. Remember, it wasn't Yaakov's idea to steal have the blessing. It was his mother's idea. Blame the mother. It was his mother's idea, and his mother said, I'll take the whole blame for everything. I'll take the consequence. He had no choice. He did not have a choice. His mother, in order to honor his mother, he did need to participate, and he participated in the most limited way possible. He said as little as possible, but it still was done. So most things in our life are not 100% black, 100% white, and the challenge is that Yaakov is a man of truth. So he understands the truth of the situation at all levels. There's the truth of how Esau feels. There's the truth of what needed to be, which is Esau needed to not have that blessing. There's the truth that he bought the birthright. That was Yaakov did that himself. So he's aware of like what the truth is of the whole scenario. And that's what really truth is being aware of what's the super truth of all of the different facets. And someone who can admit that is someone who is really living a true life. We talk about, this isn't the same as Esau and Yaakov, but we talk about the debates between the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai. And why one of the reasons why we follow the school of Hillel is because Hillel was able to say the perspective of the house of Shammai. He would present it with, well, Shammai, he didn't say, well, Shammai thinks this, I can't believe he thinks this. He would say, and Shammai beholds this, and for this reason, and these are all of the merits of Shammai's point, and here is what I think. So to be able to recognize what's the point of the other person. Says, other than a discussion that was like between Korach and that rebellion, all other debates, all other issues have a point on both sides. And the person who's living a world of truth is able to see the truth of the other person's perspective. It may be 0.1% truth, but there's a point. And to be able to recognize that is to live in a place of truth. That's our goal. And Yaakov was able to do that. He was able to see that. And to say that even when he was being threatened, to say, you know, Esau has a point. He lost the blessing, and I have some sympathy for that. Okay, so when he is continuing on, and he says this about his staff, that he only had this, and now he has all of this wealth, which again points to the idea of having emunah. If God wants you to have something, you're going to have it. He didn't have to do anything. He came with nothing, and he couldn't say, well, you know, I got cheated by Eliphaz, and now I need to do something dastardly and devious to get money back from Laban, and he's a cheater, so I'll cheat him. So that was not his way of being. So he comes with this staff, again, always read during the month of Kislev around Hanukkah to connect the oil that was in his staff with the oil that was used for the rededication of the menorah at the time of the rededication of the temple following the purification that the Hasmoneans and the Jewish people did after the battle with the Greeks. And the battle with the Greeks was interesting because the Greeks, who are considered to be the like the descendants of Esav, they really didn't initially try to kill us. They weren't really trying to kill us. They were just trying to take us completely away from Judaism. It's like, well, you can like have a Jewish style pastrami or whatever, just don't like have the real kosher stuff. It's just like, don't do it really. Just be it kind of like a cultural thing. But join our culture. And we love it, and we think your Torah is really interesting and beautiful, and we'll put it up with the pantheon of all the great wisdom literature that's out there. We value it. But we don't want you to like be so Jewish. And the Jews were like, okay, there's so many people. Yes, we want to participate. We'll come to your gymnasiums. Yeah, we'll get naked and exercise and have a great time. And some of the men tried to reverse their circumcision so they would look better naked in the gymnasiums. Like, well, we want to participate in this. So the Jews were always all about, yeah, we want to be part of you. And Yaakov was like, we don't. We cannot be part of you. And when he says to, in this verse 12, he says, rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. Back on page 173 in Vayishlach, again, rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav, for I fear him lest he come and strike me down, mother and children. So this is a strange phrase to say, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav. First of all, at this point, everybody knows that Esav is his brother. So either you say, save me, rescue me from the hand of my brother, and everyone knows it's Esav, or you say, rescue me from the hand of Esav, and everyone knows it's my brother. So why from the hand of Esav, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esav? Because there were two threats. This one threat was from the hand of Esav, who wants to kill me, who physically wants to destroy me. But the hand of my brother is from the hand of my brother who will come to me in closeness and say, but we're brothers, you know, we're all in this together, and who will want to influence me in his way of being in this world, which I know is the wrong way, is the wrong thing. But someone comes to you as a brother in friendship, in kindness, it's much harder to resist. So Yaakov is rewarded, if we can say that, for putting his life in the proper priority. Because what does he say first? What's his first concern? Rescue me, please, from the hand of my brother, the one who's going to come to me in kindness. So not only if this meeting is going to be a meeting where he's going to try to kill me, I'm worried about that, but I'm more worried if he's going to want to join me, if he's going to come in kindness and say, let's be pals and let's just join up together and then we can all be the same and you can just be like me and we are brothers. He was more concerned about that, and as he should be, because then we see, right, for when they do come to each other, and let's see when they come to him. Hold on a second. If you turn to page 176, and when they come together, and let's pick it up. Patricia, did you already read? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Susan, would you like to read page 177, verse 4?
Esau ran towards him, embraced him, fell upon his neck, and kissed him,
then they wept. Okay. So Esau was running towards him, embracing him. It looks like a Hallmark, you know, commercial. The brothers, long-lost brothers, he's running towards him. He embraces him and falls upon his neck and kissed him. So the question is, what was really going on here? And we see, if you look in the Hebrew, the bottom line on the word vayishkahehu, and he kissed him, there's all these little dots above each letter. Okay, those dots are in the Torah also. Those dots are written in the Torah on the word, and he kissed him, because there's a whole question of, so what was the nature of this kiss? So one interpretation says it was a sincere kiss. And so you say, oh, well, then that's okay. It's like, no, that's not okay. So if it was a sincere kiss, then we have the problem of Esau wants this relationship to be this close relationship, and he wants me to suck me into his way of being in the world. Or some say, no, it was a kiss that that Esau really was going to bite Jacob's neck, and it was going to harm him, to come up in, you know, a pretend, you know, like they can have somebody who comes up and embraces you and then stabs you. Okay, so that happens in relationships, and it has happened. It's the whole reason why a left-handed person, the word for left is siniestra, is because it means sinister, because a left-handed person could shake hands with somebody in a guise of friendship and draw their sword with the left hand and do harm. Because that's why you shake hands, is to show you don't have arms. So if you shake hands with your right hand, that means you're coming in friendship. But if you're left-handed, such as myself, then you can come and shake hands at the same time and kill. So that's possible. So it's possible for somebody to come and pretend like they're embracing you, and then when you're caught off guard, to then try to kill you. So there's a debate about what was that kiss all about. Was it a kiss of biting, or was it a true kiss? What are we mostly concerned about? We're concerned about the whole thing. We're concerned if it was a real kiss, and we're concerned if it was a biting kiss. So it says that the Midrash says that Yaakov's neck turned to marble. So, says, and they both cried. It says that Yaakov cried because Esau tried to bite him, and Esau cried because his teeth met marble. So they were both crying, that was the weeping. But some say, no, that they were weeping just over the reunion of it, but that it was going to be, this was not a relationship that could really exist together. And that, interestingly, other places where something is considered hard, it usually refers to metal. But in the case of Yaakov, it talks about stone, it talks about marble. So there's a unique property. Unlike metal, which can receive spiritual impurity, which is why we kosher dishes, you can kosher something, you immerse it in boiling water or heat it up or whatever, because it can receive spiritual impurity or actual real impurity. It says stone cannot. That's why we love our granite countertops. Okay, so you can purify those. So the turning to stone, it says stone does not receive tuma, stone does not receive spiritual impurity. Actually, take that away about what I just said about the countertops, you have to kosher them, but you can. But just rocks or something, they cannot receive impurity. So it says this was the protection, so that Yaakov's neck turns to marble for both reasons. If he means physical harm, so he's protected and will not be hurt. If he means a kindness and he's coming as a brother and it will be spiritually harmful, his neck, which is like very critical part of our body, is protected from the spiritual harm that Esau would be bringing by coming close. If somebody's kissing you already, they're pretty close to you. That means you're pretty much going to be impacted by whatever it is they're doing. So that's why we're careful about who we kiss. It's because we're impacted by that. So, and then they wept. So then Esau wants Yaakov to follow, and he says, you know, come and follow me and we'll travel together. And Yaakov is very clear but very polite about resisting Esau's request that they all travel together. So, I'm sorry? Yes, he's very diplomatic, very, very diplomatic. So, let's take a look at how he says this here.
Ellen, just need to go back to the dots. So the dots on the Vaishka.
Hey. Yes, and he kissed him.
It's just a warning to be careful about this kiss.
It's saying that this kiss was something to be concerned about. Yeah, so and those dots indicate that this is something to pay attention to. Now, there's other places. I'm sorry? There are other dots other places, and I don't know where they are. I didn't investigate that. So there is a exegetical, whatever that means, exegetical rule, that if there are more dots than letters, then you focus on the dots, of what the dots mean. If there are more letters than dots, then you focus on what the letters mean, and that's the dominant issue. In this case, you will see they're equal, which is why it calls into question. It's like we must pay attention to the dots and the letters, to the word as well as to the meaning of what was going on. But I don't know the other places where there are dots. So that's interesting. All right. So now Esau is like, he seems to be very buddy-buddy. And now we're on page 179. And verse 12, and let's see what it says here. And let's see, go on. And I'm so sorry, I don't know your name, though, sitting next to Sue. Yes, would you like?
I don't know.
No, okay. Bobby, would you like to read?
And he said, travel on and let us go. I will proceed alongside you.
Okay, this is Esau speaking. So let's go. I'll travel with you. We're going to be all together now. And as is, I'm sorry?
In Hebrew, it's leneg decha, it means across you.
Right, opposing you. It means like, lenegdeha is like naked. It means opposite you. Well, it says alongside. Alongside is English. It means like as a counterpart to you.
Yeah.
So that's what it means. Like we're going together. You here, me here, and we're going this way. Yes, we're going in a parallel way. Yaakov was like, oh, this is really dangerous. It's like, okay, it was going to be dangerous enough if we were going to have a warfare and that kind of a military encounter. Now this is getting really dangerous because now he wants to be with me, and this is going to be a big problem. So, Rachel, do you want to continue there? Let's see what Yaakov says. But he said to him,
my Lord knows that the children are tender, and the nursing flocks and cattle are upon you. If they will be driven hard for a single day, then all the flocks will die.
And 14 also.
Let my Lord go ahead of his servant. I will make my way at my slow pace according to the gate of the drove before me and the gate of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir.
Okay, Seir is Har Seir, which is Esau's territory. So he's saying, you know what, you know, the cattle, we can't really drive them so fast. You know, if we push them too hard, they're going to die. And you know how children are. They're kind of dawdling. And I've got all these kids and the grandchildren. It's going to be a little hard. So we're just kind of going slowly. So I'll meet you at Har Seir. It says, and that's a prophecy. It says in the end that Yaakov and the Jewish people will meet up with Esau at Har Seir, and there will be a final judgment between Yaakov and Esau. So he says, so you just go ahead. And Esau says, well, I'll just send some people with you then to accompany him. He's like, no, I don't need that. Just as if I have favor in your eyes, if we're okay, then you just go ahead and we'll see you later. Well, that see you later never happens in their lifetime. There is no see you later. There is no see you later. So that see you later is still waiting to happen in the future. And the future says that will happen. Judy. Of Rome, yes. Esav is Edom, which is Rome. And then the Greeks and Rome are tied together. So again, that's the whole thing with Greece and the brotherliness that we experienced from the Hellenists, who were not interested in killing us. They wanted to assimilate us. That's what Esav wanted to do. He says, I'll just assimilate you into me, and then I'll also be done with you. Okay, so that's the other way to do us in. And anybody who's seen the Pew report is like, that, you know, the friendly approach works really well. That's everyone wants love to be part of it. And the Jewish people are, it's interesting, because people are always accusing the Jewish people for being standoffish and staying away from everybody. The Jewish are the most joint group there is. We are always like, whatever nationality we come from, whatever country we come from, we are more that than anybody. Again, why so many Jews in Germany did not think the Holocaust could happen. It's like, I'm a German. I'm a proud German. I served in the, you know, whatever. It's like, so it's like, okay, that's what happened. So we are not any of those things. We are separate. Yaakov was like, the key to the success of this relationship will be our separation. He was not rude. He was friendly. He was happy. This is my brother. But in this case, this was not a relationship that could be too close because it really would have ruined the entire Jewish people. Okay.
They
do see.
They get together for Isaac.
To bury Isaac.
That's the only time they're together. That's
and that's it.
I was asking.
Yes.
I thought they were together at Isaac's.
Only there, but they don't meet at Har Seir.
No, they do not. And it's that meeting at Har Seir that is the.
That's the final prophecy.
That's the final judgment, not the.
Right, not when they went to the burial. No, exactly. Har Seir is a land, the part, I don't know exactly the territory, that's considered Esau's land. That was his inheritance. The Jewish people have the land of Israel. Esau has Har Seir.
Not in Israel.
Not in Israel.
Is Har Seir, is what's now Jordan?
I'm not sure. You asked me, I don't even know exactly, you know, how to get to the store. I don't know. I don't know. Okay, I'm sorry. You'll have to consult the map to look for Har Seir. It's not in the land of Israel, because the land of Israel is Yaakov's inheritance. Har Seir is Esau's. And it's not just one mountain. It's a whole... I'm sorry? Edom. Yes, Edom. That is the world of Esau. Okay, the final thing I'd like to talk about, just in our concluding few minutes, if it's okay, is before Yaakov meets up with Esav, he has the very famous wrestling with the angel. And I just want to just look at one word before he has the, or actually two words. If you don't mind, if we could take a few extra minutes, I just want to end with this. That if we go back to, hold on one second. We're going back to the wrestling of, with the angel. Start with the angel. Okay. On page 175. And two words we want to look at in verse 25. So if we want to go there, Kay, would you like to read that verse 25 on page 175?
Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn.
Okay, great. So this man, we understand, it was not a man, some random person who happened to be in the desert who comes to wrestle Jacob. Like, what is that? So that it was understood to be, it was the angel of Esav. That this was kind of like a pre-battle battle. And it was the angel of Esav. And first of all, it says that Jacob was left alone. And this is a really interesting idea. So it says, Vayivater Yaakov levado, that he was left alone. And on one hand you say, well, that wasn't so smart. He should have had somebody with him. But this comes, and this was from again from Rabbi Abba Wagensberg, talking about Jacob being left alone, about the importance of being alone. That this battle really had to take place. It wasn't like, oh, too bad, he was left alone, and now he's going to get, because he was alone, now he's going to get attacked. It was that because he was alone, he was able to be attacked and to prevail. Because being alone has to do with being able to be with oneself and to focus on who you really are. Like, who are you? And that, especially in our society and today, people don't spend enough time alone by themselves. And this doesn't mean listening to your iPad, your iPod, whatever. This doesn't mean anything. This means alone time with oneself to reflect on who we are. Not who other people want us to be, who we think that we other people want us to be. Again, something that has to do with what the expectations are of others. Who does Hashem want me to be? Who does God want me to be? And if we don't spend enough time alone with ourselves, and it can be in the car, to turn off the radio, turn off the whatever, and to just be alone and think, that we will not be able to withstand all the trials and tribulations that come our way, nor will we be able to reach our full potential. So that it was Jacob being alone that allowed him to prevail over this angel of Esav, because he was able to have time to think and focus on who he was. Interestingly, when it says that they wrestled, that the word for this wrestling that they had here is an interesting word. They wrestled with him until dawn. The word is vayeavek. Vayeavek means to wrestle, but it's related to the word avak, which means dust. Okay, avak is dust. So it says that they had literally had a dust up, that this wrestling caused the dust to go up. And it says the dust went up so high that it went all the way up to the Kisei HaKavod. It went all the way up to the throne of glory. That's a lot of dust, okay? We're not talking about the throne of glory. It's high up. It says, what does that mean, that the dust went up to the Kisei HaKavod? It says, the purpose of a wrestling match is to see who is going to prevail. And that this kind of dust, it says, what does dust do? On one hand, does dust have too much substance to it? But what if it gets in your eyes? You can't see. You're totally blinded. It says, this dust up was about trying to blind Yaakov to who he was in the world, and that it almost succeeded, and there was an injury to him. He doesn't come out free and clear. It says that he was injured in his yurecho, in his thigh, that there was an injury, a displaced sinew in his thigh. And that this was a wounding of him, but that later he recovers and is shalem and he is whole. But that the injury of this was something that does happen to the Jewish people. So in a way, this is a prophecy of what the Jewish people's challenge is going to be throughout history, is that we are going to have a dust up. We're going to be challenged, and not necessarily by something that's going to